This works. Hello, hello. Okay, that works. So as I talked to you earlier, no more material to be covered today. I'll go ahead and do a quick review, and then I'll take questions. So I'll have to figure out how to answer the questions, but we'll do. Okay. So what has been covered in class is pretty much on a web page here. So the first class wasn't much. In the second class, I talked about what's an operating system, how do we do booting, loaders, bootloaders, resident monitors, historic stuff. What is a resident monitor? Why did somebody invent that? Efficiency of operation of this thing called the CPU and memory. And I skipped a lot of stuff on how the archaic hardware, input-output hardware worked. I jumped into more of buffering, spooling, and multitasking. Essentially because all that old hardware, paper tape punches and stuff is not very relevant. So we talked about the basic resident monitors and bootstrap loaders, which is still around, and things that are still around, like buffering, spooling. You'll see all of this happening on any computer system today. And the starting point of operating systems, or the basic mechanism that makes operating systems possible, is protection. And protection involves memory protection, CPU protection, and interrupts. Interrupts are used for mode switching, apart from other things, and memory protection has to be some map of the memory that a process has to use, base and bound registers in the older days, and page tables in more modern times. So at that point, I introduced the notion of system calls, because you have modes, so you have to get into privileged mode. You cannot do that from a user-level program. So you go through an interrupt, call a system call, so that the operating system code can run in privileged mode and do things that is not possible at the user level. So that takes care of class 2 and 3. Similar stuff in class 4, structures, layers, boot, some stories over there. But then how do you take a program and make it execute? And execution involves processes, PCBs, and context switching. That is, you will do multitasking, so you will have multiple contexts, multiple processes. What does that mean? How is that supported? So we need some stuff called process control blocks. After having process control blocks, we can switch context from one process to the other. We talked about how context switching is done. That way, P1 running suddenly gets switched to P2, and later comes back to P1. And that's the absolute basics of running multitasking systems. And since you've built some of that, you should be aware of how that works. More context switching, processes and threads. What's the difference between processes and threads? I did notice that you must have gotten an email from Lawrence Liu, who's the TA for the class and the recitation. He put together a pretty good, resource sheet. So that has a lot of information on it. It's a good reference. And it has more information about processes and threads than I may have covered. And process states and scheduling queues, Gantt charts and all that. How are processes created? What do they cooperate like? What are the process creation, process cooperation. I didn't cover process cooperation at this stage. Maybe I miswrote something. It's probably process scheduling. And we have scheduling metrics. This is where we were getting into scheduling. What does scheduling mean? How do you pick the next one? And how do you define what's a good one based on CPU utilization, turnaround time, and what was the other one? Waiting time. So we started with non-preemptive scheduling, which is FIFO, shortest job first and priority. Shortest job first being the optimal policy, neither implementable nor desirable, but it performs the best in turnaround time. Talked about system calls again. Got into preemptive scheduling, round robin, multi-level queue, multi-level feedback queue, and this forms the basis of all real schedulers today. So it's a mixture of multi-level feedback queue and MLQ and some other parameters that can be tweaked, which leads to things like the Windows scheduler and the Linux scheduler, and how do you do scheduler evaluations. Now we got into, well, okay, what does it mean that you compile a program, you link it with the library, you load it, and you run it? So how does that work? How threads work? And then it was this long story about concurrency. Once you've got threads, you've got shared memory, you've got interaction, which is the same thing. All processes are threads in the kernel. You can have threads at the user level. You can have threads at the kernel. All of them behave the same way. You have race conditions and concurrency problems. So we need critical sections, just like that railroad. And how do we achieve critical sections? We can try to build it in software. That got us nowhere. We talked about two process solutions, Peterson's algorithm, Lamport-Bakery algorithm, and all that. And these are pretty complicated, hard to understand methods of getting critical sections, not very practical. So the practical one is test and set, and forgot to put it there, interrupt disabling. Interrupt disabling for uniprocessors, test and set for multiprocessors. Today all systems are multiprocessors, so test and set is the method of choice. How do you do test and set? What does it mean? But even test and set is a low-level one. It does spinning, so there is this concept of semaphores, which has been around forever, and it's a more evolved cousin, the monitor, very similar things that are used for all concurrency purposes, be it inside the kernel, be it at the user level. It is semaphores and monitors. That's the standard method. How do you use semaphores? The techniques are kind of demonstrated in writing the producer-consumer problem, the readers and writers problem, and the dining philosophers problem. Three different problems dealing with concurrency and synchronization, looking at it from three different angles and has its own methods of solution. And we did spend four classes over it. So we did spend quite a bit of time on these classical process coordination problems. Idea is to make you be able to write process coordination programs, synchronization and concurrency handling. Because of the project we talked, we talked about how in general semaphores are implemented. We can do busy waiting, or we can do blocking. Busy waiting is good for short critical sections. Blocking is the method of choice for longer critical sections. And we spent a class talking about monitors, which is the next step beyond semaphores. And so all concurrency and dealing with processes and CPUs was covered before the midterm. After the midterm, we started with memory management, physical memory, logical memory, paging systems, page tables, the translation look-aside buffer. Beyond paging is segmentation. Beyond segmentation is page segmentation. Then it gets more and more complex. And somewhat simplified version is the VAX and the Intel 32-bit paging architecture, which are very similar. Not exactly the same, but very similar. Now, paging systems is not really virtual memory. Virtual memory is where it's a paging system, but it has the ability of not having a page table completed because you have missing pages. So pages that are not heavily used will not be in memory, it will be in some swapping store. And then you have to do demand paging and create this illusion of having a massive amount of memory when you don't have it. And that's done through virtual memory. It has valid bits in the page table. You have to bring in page fault handling, page replacement policies, Belady's anomaly, various algorithms. None of them proved to be very useful, so we use LRU approximations as page replacement algorithms for real life. Deadlocks, as I mentioned, is a thing stuck onto operating systems courses, although it's not terribly related to operating systems, but it is in-depth study of how deadlocks happen, can happen, prevention, avoidance, and detection, and recovery. So that was the next few classes. So we had to talk about resource allocation graphs, Banker's algorithm, weights for graphs, deadlock detection in resource allocation graphs, and recovery, how to, once you have detected the deadlock, what do you do? Kill and release all locks. Towards the end of the class there, we are talking about input-output. Input-output is, there's a variety of input-output peripherals, network and disk being the most common. So we chose to focus on the disk, and I said networking will be very similar. Instead of doing both, we'll just focus on the disk, because we are talking about a single machine. This is not a networking class, it's more of a how does a machine work class. So we talked about SSDs, hard drives, how does the CPU communicate with the peripherals through those registers, device control registers and device data registers and device drivers, so that you can have scheduling, you can have overlapping of I/O wait times with execution times, so there's a link up with the CPU scheduler which takes processes and puts them in queues where they have to wait for their I/Os. Interesting topics are disk head scheduling. And then there is disk management. How is the disk layout done? How are file systems built? What's the metadata and the data in file systems? And what's the layout format of disk files? There we talked about Unix systems. I even spent some time talking about Unix I/O system calls, file system semantics, concurrency, and then wrap up access control, privilege programs, administrative or root processes, and regular processes, and escalation. So yes, there's a lot of topics here, but it's a semester-long course. Okay. I'll take questions about anything on this list, because that's what the course is about.
We don't have to implement Banker's algorithm, right? We just have to know what the...
Okay, it depends on what you mean by implement. I mean, you don't have to write a program unless... You have the notes. The notes actually gives you step-by-step of the Banker's algorithm. So I could ask you to repeat it, probably not, but I won't ask you to write a program, correct C to do it. But I could ask you questions about the Banker's algorithm. Yeah.
So our final part one is Thursday, our final part two is next Thursday.
Yeah.
Is there any difference in the topics that either test covers or both could cover anything?
Both can cover anything. They will be approximately, I will decide, somewhere between 60 to 70 minutes each, because the final is supposed to be really 120 minutes or something like that. So You'll get them. So it's basically one long exam given out in two parts. And no segregation. Some topics go on this one, some go on that one, maybe even some go on both.
Is it going to be multiple choice write-in, similar to the midterm?
It'll be similar to the midterm, but I am sometimes, I do toy with multiple choice questions, but part one is not multiple choice, part two maybe. Grading curve is on the final score, not the final exam score. Weighted score, finally sort, and cut bands. Okay. Yeah.
Can you go over the differences between semaphores and monitors?
Semaphores and monitors. Okay, I pretty much rewrote the semantics of semaphores, but semaphore just has two operations. These operations have very simple semantics. That is, if the semaphore value is zero, you're going to wait. And if it's not zero, you're going to decrement it. It can be implemented as it goes negative, but the definition says it doesn't go negative. So semaphore has a value, P operation decrements it, V operation increments it. Pretty much that simple, but then you can write very complex programs with it. The beauty is that this simple thing, but it's pretty unstructured. That's the complaint thrown at semaphores. So my monitor is a similar thing, but a little bit more structured. It has this notion of classes, and a monitor is an object, and the methods are classes. Monitor is an object or a class, and then there are methods. So monitors have methods, and over here you somehow enter the monitor, and here you exit the monitor. And all execution here is a critical section. So in semaphores, you're building critical sections whenever you need it. In monitor, you assume that the monitor method executes in a critical section. Of course, there are no methods and classes in a C programming language, so there's a bunch of kludges to build that. But if it was Java, that's how it would be done. That there would be a monitor class. And in the method, you have code that executes in a critical section. So all this is like atomic. And you can have a wait on a condition. And this condition always blocks. There's no value to check. And you can have a signal on a condition. And this will wake up one sleeping or blocked process. So it's a little different from semaphores, but semaphores do things like blocking, waking up, and they can be used to build critical sections. Monitors, you assume it's a critical section, and you do wait and signal. Wait does not check the value of the condition. It just blocks. So wait is like a block, and signal is like a wake somebody up. And then there is more complex semantics over it, because if you block, you can't hold up the monitor. You've got to step outside. When you signal, the signal process cannot really execute because you're inside the monitor. The signal process obviously blocked inside the monitor, so when it executes, it'll be again inside the monitor. So those things are much more complex in its semantics than a semaphore is. So semaphore is low-level programming. This is more high-level programming. Yeah.
So can you still run into the same issues that you do with semaphores, like that
locking? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You can run into deadlocks. You can run into starvation. It's the same thing. It doesn't automatically fix those problems. You create a monitor to run all of your methods. So it's like instantiating a... if you're doing it in C, you just write functions that you call are monitor functions, and then you put explicit enter and exit calls. Pthreads supports that. And is done through Pthreads mutex lock and mutex unlock and things like that. I'm not quite sure how Java handles it. It probably automatically does it. Yeah. An example of test and set? Yeah. So test and set is an opcode. It's not a C or Java function. It's an opcode. It's an actual machine-level opcode on the CPU. So it is one opcode that takes one address as its operand. And it takes the address, a memory address. Since you're running threads, this memory address is shared by multiple threads. It copies the old value. It copies the value that's in the memory address into a register. The register is always private to the thread. And atomically sets the value of that memory address X to 1. So at the end of the test and set, the value of the target X will always be 1. It may have had a value other than 1, but you've kind of captured that value and put it in your private register, and then you can check it. Sounds useless, but it's beautifully useful. How do you use this thing? It'll always set the value to 1, and it'll tell you, by the way, privately, that the value was 1 or the value was whatever it was. So the idea being, if I have this ability, and it's atomic, that's important, if I have this thing, and I have two threads, T1 and T2, and I do a test and set here on X, and I do a test and set here on X, I have to make sure the value of x is 0 to start with. And this test and set happens simultaneously. The final value of x will be 1. But one of them will return 0, one of them will return 1 in a private register. So one of these threads will capture the 0 and set it to 1. The other thread will capture the 1 and set it to 1. Whoever got the 0 won the prize. So 0 is the prize. And only one person, even if you've got 10 threads, only one person thread will get the prize. And that can enter the critical section. This one will go, oops, I didn't get it. Let me try again. And eventually that guy will set it to 0 and this guy will get it. Okay?
So test and set is where you try to set it to 1.
Test and set is maybe not a very good word for it, but it test and set. Set means set to 1. It comes from old binary stuff. Set is 1, clear is 0. So you set it to 1, and you test it actually afterwards. That is, what was it before? Yeah.
So when you use the test and set function for like a critical section, you'd have to set the variable back to
0. Yeah. So you use the test and set in a loop, and you do a busy wait here, if 1. And here also you will do a busy wait if 1. Of course, this won't busy wait. So these two is like lock. And then you set x is equal to 0, and this is unlock. So, and here is your critical section. And here is your critical section until x is equal to 0. Test and set is only used for busy waiting. And then so how do you block using test and set? That is, you've got to look at the semaphore construction. I will test and set, busy wait, grab the value of the semaphore in a critical section, check if I'm allowed to proceed, then I'll decrement it. If not, I will do a proper block operation and go in there. So you need a semaphore to do that, the counter and all that. So you can build blocking on top of test and set, but test and set is not blocking, it's busy waiting.
So you just get a blocking semaphore inside your test and
set? Yes, to do a blocking semaphore, you need atomicity, short period of atomicity to decrement the semaphore and check its value. So you grab that atomicity using a busy waiting test and set.
Test and set
on some variable in the... The semaphore will consist of a test and set variable, a counter, and a queue. So you do a test and set on the test and set field, which is an integer in the semaphore.
But for like this class and general operating systems,
test and set generally considered to be busy weight? Yes. Test and set is always busy weight. Can be any number of threads, yes. Yeah.
So everything we talked about after the midterm was more like idea based and not a lot of code that we were talking about. Should we expect like written answers to a lot of those questions for stuff after the midterm?
That's more of a problem. I mean, yeah, I cannot ask you to write memory management code. So the coding part, like write some pseudocoded program, is for the concurrency part. The rest is all concepts. So algorithms, so how do you do deadlock detection, or what is the situation, or page tables, what do they contain? Here's a sample page table, what does this mean, that kind of thing.
Speaking of page tables, can I go over page tables?
Yeah. So for this thing, you have RAM. This is the real hardware. You have memory addresses from 0 through N in RAM. So you got a gigabyte of RAM, it'll be 0 to 1 billion. I'm going to assume the process memory is smaller than the total RAM you have. Makes things simpler. So process has a space, starts at 0. All processes, logical memory, it's not real, it starts at memory location 0. But there's only one RAM that starts at memory location 0. So firstly, conceptually, I split the process into pages. Fixed size, let's say it's 1K pages, 1K byte, word, whatever. And this thing is split into 1K, and these are called frames. And these are called pages. And then if I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these, I will have to put these 5 in 5 frames. So this is going to frame 0, this is going to frame 3, this is going to frame 5, this is 7, let's say, and this is 20. So then I build a page table. I don't have enough space there. Which will be a mapping. So in the page table, I will have 3, 0, 7, 5, 20. Why that jumble? That's the order. The first page is in 0. No, first page is in 3, second page is in 0. And the implicit numbering of the page table is the index. This is an array that is not stored. And so when the memory management unit gets a reference to page number, we do a page number to offset. This page number looks up the page table, and that frame number is substituted. I messed up. So a memory address in that process space is a byte address. It's just an integer. When I break it up into two pieces, I can divide it, and one part will be the page number, one part will be the offset. That is how far inside that page. So the offsets here will be the same as the offsets there. But since the pages have been shuffled, to get to the real address here, the physical address, I replace the page number with the frame number. And that's the job of the MMU. So paging consists of having a page table and an MMU that switches page numbers to frame numbers. And then all these processes think they live in page number 0 through M, but they're not. They're scattered all over. And we're just using the appropriate page table. The page table belongs to each process, has its own page table. The mapping happens. And that's the magic. Lazy pure demand paging. Okay, what do you think that means? No, and let me not waste time. Okay. So it's demand paging. Some pages are in memory, some pages are not. If it's not in memory, you'll bring it. So the purest form of demand paging is no pages in memory at start. So moment the process starts running, its first memory hit will cause a page fault. It'll bring in that page. That'll be a good page to bring in. And as it executes, it'll hit more pages, and slowly the working set will be there. Okay? This is opposed to pre-paging, where operating systems kind of figure out this process is going to start at its start location. Let me bring in that page, and let me bring in the first few data pages and the bottom of the stack pages and preload them so that it won't generate as many page faults and it'll work faster. So lazy may not, I mean pure may not be good, but instead of trying to be intelligent about it, let the process decide what it wants. Okay. And the lazy part says, so we bring in pages, eventually the memory will be full. Not so lazy or eager demand paging will have a point at which it says we don't have too many free memory. Let me start throwing pages out and keep space. Lazy says, why bother? Let it fill up. Okay? And why do you keep pages empty? Maybe they're useful. So just let it fill up. Once it fills up and then you need somebody page faults, then panic. Throw something out to put this in. And again somebody will page fault. So you'll just get a lot of page faulted page out things. Is that a good way? Well, that's like an opinion. I think you should always keep some pool of pages free so you can bring it in without throwing stuff out. And in the background, throw stuff out when they're idling or something like that. So this is just the extreme. No pages in memory, and demand paging kicks in when memory is full. Yeah.
So is that when memory leaking happens?
No. Memory leaking has got nothing to do with operating systems. Memory leaking is a programmer problem where you allocate memory and then you don't free it up. So you do a malloc, you don't do a free, and slowly you keep doing malloc and your memory just grows and grows. Yeah.
So kind of about the same memory leak, just a quick question. Does that mean that like the OS itself also sees that memory is not like free, so it's not going to be able to access?
The OS sees that memory as used memory.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't know that you should throw it away. So you haven't asked it to throw it away. So it's yours. And you're not using it. So it just sits there clogging things up. Yeah. Page table caching. So the page table cache is called TLB. Now, I can be a purist and say, like, why are we talking about page table caching? All caching is the same thing. There's nothing different between a page cache and an instruction cache and a data cache, really. But architects decide to have three kinds of caches. and level 1, level 2, and page table cache. And so page table cache is exactly the same as the instruction cache, but it's given a different name. So all caches follow the rule that you have a fixed number of entries in cache, which reflects a whole bunch of entries in memory. So in case of page table caches, these are page tables, page table entries. In case of instruction caches, these are opcodes, and that's in the instruction. Then there is this stuff, which I'm not that familiar with, like fully associative caches. What was the other one? This 230 material. Fully associative, something else, I forget the terminology. So let's talk about the fully associative. That's the most complicated cache. That is, each entry has the entire address of where it came from in the cache. And so when you're looking for that page table entry or data or instruction, you search the cache contents. So if you look at memory, memory addresses are not stored in memory. That's just a number that's used to find the address. Because all addresses are sequential, so if you say 10, you just go down 10, look it up there. That number is not stored. But if you store the value y in cache, this cache that is not organized like that. So you've got to store the value x in here. And when you access memory, you use the value x to find y. When you use the value x, this cache will first grab that x, see if it's in the cache. If not, it'll let it go to memory. If it is, we'll get the value y from here. So it has to do a parallel search of what it contains. And that's true for whether it's a TLB or it's not. But TLB is a word that's used for storing only the page table entries. So there is just three separate cache boxes on a CPU, one containing data, one containing page tables, one containing instructions. And why do they do that? They must have run some performance tests or segmentation things and figured that's the best way, but that's hardware design. Don't know much about that. All caches, whichever kind, are somewhat associative. There are various types. And all caches are completely invisible to all software. Neither the operating system nor any application program is aware that there's a cache, is aware that there's pipelining. So these are hardware artifacts that is well hidden. We only work with opcodes and operands and things like that. Yeah.
There was another question in those example homeworks about the swapping. And first of all, could you talk about swapping?
Okay, so it's about swapping.
Yes. The question of, like, does the whole process happen in memory?
And does the whole process, in a swapping system? Swapping system, I really didn't cover swapping systems. There's no such, although all operating systems call this demand paging store the swap store, it's a misnomer. Swapping systems don't exist anymore. And swapping systems means whole process has to be in memory, not demand paging. So these two are kind of the same thing. Swapping means so you take a process, you swap the whole thing in, you run it, then you swap the whole thing out, then you bring in another one, or have maybe two processes running. Demand paging is a much more sophisticated swapping. It works on pages, and there are pages of all processes that are missing and some not missing. So this is an older system. It does full processes in, full processes out. It's much easier to do that if you don't have hardware. But hardware is easy peasy, cheap now. Okay, I'm waiting for more questions. Yeah?
Over system calls.
System calls. Oh, this can take forever. Okay. So we are running a application program. And so these are all opcodes. And all of these opcodes have a restriction that you cannot use any privileged codes here. It'll cause a problem. The CPU will complain. It'll give you an illegal instruction trap. So since you cannot use any privileged opcodes, you cannot do a whole variety of things. Memory allocation, input, output, networking, variety of functions is not available to you. So in order to do that, we will have a trapdoor. And let's say I want to do, at this point, send a packet or on a network. Okay? Now, send a packet on a network or write a block to disk, these things cannot be done at the application programming level. So you must have a system call that does it. And that one should be here. And somehow we've got to change to privilege mode. So there's a bunch of things that happen. So let's see. We have a piece of function here called send a packet over network. And the opcodes is used here are privileged codes because it is accessing the network controller's device registers, and those things are not to be touched by an application program. Now we've got to glue that to here and switch to privileged mode. How do we do that? The technique is you generate an interrupt. And this will generate a software interrupt. And Linux uses, what is it, OX80? Hex80. Hex80 is the code for that particular type of interrupt. And there is one interrupt handler in the kernel for Hex80 interrupts. All system calls go into an Hex80 interrupt. When this interrupt happens, its interrupt vector will consist of an address which will point to here and a code which will be in a address and status. And this will contain privileged bit on. So it will load an address into the PC and will load something called a status register into the status register, essentially a bit pattern into the status register, which will turn the privilege bit on. Moment the privilege bit is turned on, you're not executing here, you're executing there. Okay? So you did cause an interrupt turning the privilege bit on, but you lost control, it went there. Now that it's here, this is the all system calls entry point. And before, so all system calls entry point will say, why did I come here? And if the answer is it's a packet, then you come to this point, call this point. Now, how do you determine why did you come here? Well, before causing the interrupt, it's the job of the application programmer to stick some values in some registers R1 and R2. Which is the type of system call, what is the parameters and all that stuff. And here we are going to check the values of those registers and branch to appropriate system calls. And since I'm calling this system call, at the end here I'm going to do a return from interrupt, which I was talking about RTI. And this RTI instruction will bring me back here and will reset the privileged bit so that I'm no longer in privileged mode. So I jump into the kernel in privileged mode, do a demultiplexing of the thing to jump to wherever my correct system call is, pass the parameters through registers, make it do my job. It'll do a lot of checking. Are you permitted to do this? Should I do it for you? Does it need scheduling? All that code is over here. You don't have to worry about it. It'll do the job. Go back to the place it was called from, which will do a return from interrupt, which will go back to exactly where the system call was called. Yeah.
So a while back, it was the idea of the MMU turning off. Does it not turn off the MMU? Does it just automatically have the power to turn?
When you go into privileged mode, a lot of things happen. So one of them is the MMU. MMU doesn't have to be turned off because the kernel is the same. Those addresses are beyond the MMU's control. So they're in flat physical addresses. Secondly, all checking is turned off. So bounce checking, mode checking, it's like it's a super user. So there's nothing to, you can execute anything over there. So once that privileged bit is on, you have superpowers.
So you don't need to turn off the MMU before, it's able to turn on the privileged bit on its own?
This interrupt will turn on the privileged bit.
Oh,
okay. So that doesn't turn on the privileged bit. The jump turns on the privileged bit automatically. And the return disables it. So the kernel code always executes in privileged mode. And the user code can never turn on. It can try to fake an interrupt, but if you do that, you'll go into the kernel. You cannot continue execution in privileged mode. Yeah. Yes. So while that stuff is happening, the scheduler doesn't interrupt, the timer interrupt. The timer interrupt can interrupt and can context switch it out. That's why kernels are messy. At any point you can be context switched.
So switching to privileged mode is only the job of the kernel, right?
Yes. Switching to privileged mode is done by an interrupt int instruction. Okay. So it's a hardware, hard-coded thing. Yeah?
So like when you context switch, does it also have the like the user bit or like the mode bit to understand if it switches from?
Yes, because the context switcher is in the kernel. So when it comes in, it's in privileged mode. Okay, so it messes with the MMU, it changes the stack pointer, and it does a return from interrupt. The return from interrupt will pop the stack and go to the other process, remember the context switching routine. But since it returned from an interrupt, again the hardware will switch off privileged mode. So even in context switching, you will come from one process into the switcher, come in privileged mode. When you leave, privileged mode will be turned off, but you won't go back to where you came from. You go to the next process. Take a look at how your yield works, or rather the swap context works. It doesn't come back. Yeah.
Can you go over page segmentation?
Page segmentation. Page segmentation, the process thinks, like paging is invisible to the process. Segmentation is not. Segmentation is a memory management scheme that the process is aware of segments. Page segmentation starts off at the process side that it's a segmentation scheme. There's no paging, but there is. So the process believes it has several segments of memory, segment 0, segment 1, segment 2. And each segment, it can choose to assign data of this kind, data of that kind, library functions or whatever. That's up to the application programmer. This has gone out of fashion because even programmers don't want to mess with segments. But if they did, we have page segmentation. Now that we have segments here, there will be in the operating system a segment table. The segment table will contain the three entries because there are three segments. And the segment table is supposed to contain where in the main memory are these segments, just like a page table. Except the page segmentation scheme says, no, we sneak in a whole paging mechanism below the segment mechanism. So now that we have three entries in the segment table, we stick a page table for segment 0 into here, and a page table for segment one. For segment one is here. These entries here will contain the frame numbers in RAM. So on, if you look at it from the RAM point of view, it's all pages, frames. If you look at it from the process point of view, it's segments. And the middle is this hash. So then I talked about VAX, which says, like, look, you don't need any more than three segments. Put the code in one, code and data in one, stack in the other, and the kernel in the third. It simplifies matters. But in the segmentation scheme, you can have 10, 15, 20 segments with various properties. I don't think it has proved very successful. Well, it's a nice idea.
So you're talking about have the same offsets when you're talking about pages?
Yeah.
How do they have the same offsets?
They have the same offsets because, do you want me to talk decimal or binary? Let me talk binary. They have the same offsets because the size of a page is a number that's a power of 2. So let's say I have 1 kilobyte, I mean 1024. Okay? So if I take a that these will be the addresses. So what about this address? So that is 1000, let's say. Oh my, I have to convert this 1000 into binary because that's a decimal number. You'll find that apart from 10 bits, all of these are zeros. And this is the same thing as the page number. How do I divide a binary quantity by 1024? That's like dividing by 2 to the power 10. Dividing by 2 to the power 10 is just cutting out the last 10 bits. So what is the page number in this system? Divide the actual address by 1024, which means essentially remove this. Here's your page number, so it's a cut. Just like if you take just decimal numbers and you say all addresses are decimal and you have my page table page size is 10 and my address is 243, you'll say, well, that's on page 24, the third byte. Okay.
So that's page number in what's that? Is that the
list is offset.
Offset.
Yeah. So 1,000, the offset will be 1,000, and the page number will be 0, because that's 1,000 slots away from the top. And similarly, you can do the math for other pages. You'll find that that is the same property. Because division by 2 is throughout one digit, division by 4 is throughout two digits. If what?
If FIFO page replacement
algorithm. FIFO page replacement, yeah.
Does this schedule also have to be FIFO?
What do you think?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And primarily because
it has no correlation.
There shouldn't be.
No, it has no correlation. I mean, they're two completely different things. Yeah, pseudocode is fair game. Go over,
how do we fix deadlocks?
There are three ways. One is and in deadlock terminology, this is called prevention. Just make sure all your programs are deadlock free and there won't be any deadlocks and we won't have to fix any. The hard part is to write deadlock free programs. If you're writing a semaphore program, you can write a deadlock free program. But there are plenty of cases where it's different things, locking, databases, completely different programs interact, you cannot write deadlock free programs. And then you have a problem. Okay? So the best way to do it is to, one person writes the whole thing and writes deadlock-free programs. The second one is not practical, resource allocation. Safe states. Example, banker's algorithm. So that works well in theory, not really in practice. Third one is you really fix deadlocks. Fix deadlocks if they happen. And that requires a little bit of explanation. That is, deadlocks will happen. If you've got non-deadlock free programming, it'll happen. So you can refer to the lecture where I covered this. You have to have either a weights for graph or a resource allocation graph. And ever so often you check for cycles in a weights for graph, or you do that elaborate algorithm of making a copy of the resource allocation graph and pretend that processes that can die are dying, they're not waiting, so we'll kill them, we'll throw away all the resources, reallocate and all that, and your resource allocation graph should collapse. And then you're fine. If the resource allocation graph doesn't collapse, then you have a deadlock. Okay? So that's the deadlock detection algorithm. Once you've detected, so no deadlock, if it says no deadlock, well, then you go like there's nothing to see here. Just keep working. And if it says yes, then so you will be left with a set of processes that are involved, that are guilty. So these processes will form a cycle in the WFG, or if you are using an RAFG, all processes will be pretend thrown away and these will remain. The residual processes are participating in a deadlock. So then you kill one of them. Which one? There's no, you might as well be random about it. Kill one of them, reclaim all its resources, your deadlock's gone.
How do you decide which process to kill?
Yeah, which process to kill? Nobody's figured out what's the correct answer. You kill the one which is the oldest, or there's a problem. You kill the one that's the youngest, there's a problem. If you kill the one which is holding the most resources, there's a problem. So might as well shoot in the dark. Deadlocks are bad. So we don't want deadlocks. So the best is if you don't have deadlocks. But if you guarantee that there will be deadlocks, then you hunt them down and take care of them. But operating systems don't deadlock. So it's application programs that do. The exams are in my office right now, and I'll be there tomorrow 2 to 3.
Okay. Yeah, near the end of last class, you went over protection and access control.
He got a question. Hold that thought.
You said there's going to be pseudocodes per game. If we were to write threads on the exam, would it be like specific, like kind of pseudocode, or would it be like more just describing?
No. Let's say I want you to write a producer consumer problem. So the code that I wrote in class for that would be the answer. So that kind of pseudocode. Okay.
Yeah, you went over protection access control near the end of last class. Would that be an exam, or?
Well, it was covered in class.
But that topic was relatively short.
Short, yeah, so it won't be very deep.
Would that be on the exam?
That I cannot answer. I mean, of course, not all 20 topics can be on the exam. Oh, maybe it can.
Since one test is this week and the other is literally a week in advance, is there any material you can tell us to focus on for the test that is in?
Which test? The first test
the
or
first the first test, like topics to focus on, so.
No, it's got a smattering of stuff from various places, yeah. So, yeah, the class has been going on for like a semester, so you're supposed to have slowly. Well, I can't answer the question. Yeah. But now everybody asks me, is it more before the midterm or after the midterm? The first one is probably going to be a little bit more after the midterm. I don't remember now. Don't hold me to that. Okay, folks want to go home. So, hey, remember the exam time is not at the class time. It's a different time. Same class. For this week it is class time. For next week it's not.